Today is Dogen Zenji's birthday, at least the day when it's usually celebrated in our tradition. And we didn't have any special ceremony for him this morning, partly because we had a monthly memorial for Kōgen Shino Roshi, our founder. So to honor Dogen Zenji and his teachings, I feel compelled to bring him up this evening. And we've also been studying the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. And we may come back to that in future times. But during this next practice period that's coming in a couple weeks, I want to really emphasize the teachings of what we call mind only. So even though the Six Ancestors' teachings, we could say, are all mind only teachings, I want to put them aside for that time and focus on the classical teachings of mind only, but also Zen teachings of mind only. So I want to temporarily wrap up Huineng, the Sixth Ancestor, with a maybe somewhat mind-only teaching tonight. So Dogen, telling a story of the Sixth Ancestor, teaching mind only, seems like an appropriate way to combine all of these into one discussion tonight, if possible. Dogen has an essay called Shobogenzo Henzan. Oh, I also, another thing to tie in tonight is following up on Patrick's talk last week on suchness, because this story is also about suchness, which is an important teaching of the mind-only school, in fact. So Henzan traditionally meant visiting teachers far and wide to inquire into Dharma. Henzan means hen is like all inclusive, and zan or san is the same as the san of Dokusan and Shosan and Chosan, and these different ceremonies of meeting that we have. So all-inclusive meeting, all-inclusive study. So it in old times, in Zen, it meant traveling around to study all-inclusively with many different teachers. And Dogen, as he often does, picks up on these classical terms and redefines them without actually telling you he's doing that. But by the end of him talking about these things, it becomes clear that the original meaning is somewhat buried in his new redefinition. So in this case of Henzan, Dogen's take on it is, all-inclusive study, it still means all-inclusive study, but it means not necessarily to include every teacher in the land of China or Japan or America, but to all-inclusively study any one point completely. All-inclusive study of one Dharma is including everything. So not only does it not mean traveling far and wide, but it means not moving at all, studying this very place, this very moment. So in Dogen's essay about all-inclusive study, he brings up the story of the sixth ancestor and a student of his who all-inclusively studied with him. The student Nan Yue, the sixth ancestor of Zen, had many students, and all the different schools of Zen branched out from his teaching. So a particular lineage of Zen travels through the sixth ancestor to Qing Yuan, Seigen Gyoshi, who was a Dharma brother of this teacher, Nan Yue. This is old China, maybe 7th century. People heard about this sixth ancestor teaching the practice and realization of immediacy, the naturally abiding Buddha nature, and were curious about that. So they would go practice all-inclusively, one practice with the sixth ancestor. And so Nan Yue went there, and when he arrived, the sixth ancestor asked him, does anyone know the story offhand? You might know it when you hear. The sixth ancestor says, what is it that thus comes? Now, we have this word Tathagata. That's an epithet of the Buddha. The Buddha called himself, actually, the Tathagata, which means thus come one, the thus come one, the one coming, or not even necessarily one, but that which comes from suchness, that coming from suchness, or coming within suchness. So in Chinese, they translated the Sanskrit word Tathagata as literally, thus come. In this case, it's a little bit different characters, but it's still maybe playing with this meaning of Tathagata, but it's the such that Patrick was talking about last week. Imo. What is it that comes such? Nan Yue came to the sixth ancestor, arrived there, seemingly appearing from somewhere else and arriving. And so the teacher asked, what is it that thus comes? Now that could apply to this person who just entered the room, or this moment of this all-inclusive moment, or the Buddha, the Tathagata. It doesn't matter so much. It'd be the same answer for any of them. What is it that thus comes? And as the story goes, he didn't respond. Maybe he just bowed and withdrew. And then Dogen Zenji's comment is that he then studied all-inclusively Henzan. He studied all-inclusively for 8 years. This lump of mud, as Dogen says, he studied this lump of mud for 8 years, all-inclusively studied thoroughly. This lump of mud could be this person, but could also be the Buddha, or this moment, this lump of mud moment. And then he went back after 8 years. He was living with the sixth ancestor during this time. He went back and said, I understand what you asked me 8 years ago when I first arrived. So the ancestor asks again, what is it that thus comes? And Nanyue's response, after 8 years of studying this intimately and intensely and completely, is to say it's this misses the mark. You might have been hoping that he would have had some more interesting answer than that after 8 years, some more helpful and illuminating answer to what is it that thus comes. But it seems it's the most all-inclusive answer. To say it's this misses the mark. And then the sixth ancestor asks, well then, is there no practice and realization? Kind of implying that he's saying, to say it's this misses the mark is saying, well, we can't say anything about anything, we can't do anything about anything, and so just the end. He just wants to see if that's what he means. Can you follow that? If someone says, to say it's this misses the mark, that's all I have to say after 8 years. So to kind of poke a little bit into this matter, the sixth ancestor says, well then, is there no practice and realization? No practice and verification of Buddha's mind? Which, as if you know Dogen, you know that this phrase, practice and realization, practice and verification, it was one of his favorite phrases, taken from this story, actually. Well then, is there no practice in verification? And Nanyue answers, it's not that there's no practice in verification. It's just that they can't be defiled. Double negatives appear often in these Zen discussions. It's not that there's no practice in realization. Which is a little different than saying, no, there is practice in realization. It's a little different than saying that there is practice in realization, and it's quite different from saying there's no practice in realization. It's not that there's no practice in realization, but it's just that it or they can't be defiled. And the can't be defiled is a little bit like a comment on it's not that there's no. So if he had said, there is practice and realization, that might be a little bit defiling. This is the kind of defilement we're talking about. Again, in Zen, defilement means to say it's this. That's why his answer, to say it's this misses the mark. To say it's this would defile the thus come one. So it's not that there's no practice in realization, it's just that they can't be defiled by, for example, saying, oh, there is practice in realization, or there's not practice in realization. They can't be defiled by anything we can say about them. And Huainong, the sixth ancestor, says, this non-defilement is what is practiced and maintained by all the Buddhas and ancestors. You are like this, I am like this. Now, keep it well. And that's the story. And I would propose that this is also about mind only, the teaching of mind only. which is about, well, it's going to take a couple months to really get into mind only through this upcoming class series, but just introducing it through a Zen lens tonight. It's about saying it's this missing the mark. We seem to be experiencing external objects. Like, this seems to be a book. It doesn't seem to be only mind. And the way that it appears as an external object to mind has to do with words and language. To say it's this, or it's a book, or it's a blue book, those are words. And we usually, when we say that as human beings, we have some sense that it's actually true, that it actually is a book. It's not like the mind, right? It's a book, and it's blue, and it's this. And that's natural that we say that. That's how we communicate in this world. But the teaching of this mind-only school says that that's, even though that's the way we usually experience the world, it's not quite accurate. It's somewhat distorted by our conceptual apparatus of mind. It's quite convincing, isn't it? You can see it, hear it, smell it, taste it, touch it, and conceptualize it. You can, you know, even from the back, it still looks like a book. There might be a certain angle if you took a photograph or something and didn't see it in 3D where it might not look like a book. It might be hard to tell at first, which is a little bit of a clue that it might not be. So it's not wrong to call it a book. I mean, it's not like bad to call it a book, but to call it a book, or to call it this, misses the mark a little bit. And we could, you know, if we're talking about the book, we could say, the Sixth Sense Sister could have said, well then, is there no book? And Nanyue could have said, well, it's not that there's no book. It's just that it can't be defiled by calling it a book instead of the mind. Even to call it a mind is still calling it something. To say the word mind, we have an image of the mind that's actually not the mind either. So this is inevitable with language. This is the how language works. So sometimes this is, you know, in Chinese you can translate these things differently. Sometimes this story is translated as, it's not that there's no practice in realization, just don't defile them. I think maybe it could be translated that way, just don't defile. But to me that's a big difference from, it's just that they can't be defiled. Which, from a practice point of view, that's the practice and teaching and verification of immediacy. It doesn't involve trying not to defile things by saying what they are, but it's that actually things can't be defiled by what we call them. They can't be. So in a way, we're off the hook, right? We can't actually defile things by this this conceptualizing of them, this naming them, and then believing that they are what we call them. They can't, things as such can't be defiled. And yet there's the practice and verification of this non-defilement. And this non-defilement is what all Buddhas and ancestors protect and maintain. It doesn't mean that they don't defile things. It's just that things can't be defiled, and that non-defilement is what's protected and maintained. Can you understand? They protect and maintain the fact, you could say the reality, that things can't be defiled even when they seem to be defiled, which is like all the time. I mean, whenever we're speaking, but even when we're not speaking, as soon as a thought arises, the slightest thought arises, in a way that's from a certain perspective, we could call that making an external world. But truly, nothing can be defiled by such thoughts and words. So it's not like we have to stop talking or thinking. That would be impossible. It's just that we have to stop believing so strongly in that what we think and say is a book or the practice or the realization is what we think it is. Which might sound kind of simple. In a way, it's kind of simple to just not believe that, but that's like basically every thought we've ever had. It's like not believing every thought, every word we've ever spoken. So, even though it's kind of simple, it's also a tall order. And are there degrees of belief? Maybe, as we get into this mind-only sutra, there's some implication that there's a phrase used in the sutra, strongly adhering to things as being what we call them. So there, that may imply that there could be a weak adherence that's still quite helpful. We could adhere just enough to this thing to be able to pick it out. If we didn't adhere to it all, we wouldn't even actually see it. It would just seem to be our mind, and we couldn't reach out with this thing and pick it up and use it. We couldn't really function in the world. So maybe we need a little bit of weak adherence to things in order to like actually live in the world and enjoy this amazing gift of life. We need a little weak adherence. But when we strongly adhere to things, that's when we run into trouble. Strongly adhere to things as being external objects other than mental projections of mind. You know, as you can imagine, there's a lot that can be said about this mind-only school of Buddhism. So we'll have this class series going to this old sutra that lays it all out with lots of words and naming in order to help us cut through the strong adherence to things being what we call them. It gives a system. Zen doesn't give many systems. Zen just after 8 years of intensively studying just comes up with the response to say it's this misses the mark. It could have been 8 years of like memorizing this 300-page sutra and telling that to the sixth ancestor, but the Zen style is simpler. Simpler version of the same thing. So after Dogen tells this story, he goes on to say, after this, after Huineng said, I am like this, you are like this, and all the Buddha's ancestors in India are like this, then Nanyue studied all-inclusively for 8 more years. Counting from the beginning to end, it's an all-inclusive study of 15 years. Now, we might think that if you add up 8 and 8, it's 16. But to say it's that misses the mark. To thus come is all-inclusive study. To open up the hall and see all Buddhas and all ancestors, where speaking about it won't hit the mark, is all-inclusive study. To open up the hall and look around and see these amazing beings, where to say amazing doesn't hit the mark, is all-inclusive study. Since entering into and seeing the picture for now, let's just say, getting the idea, seeing the picture of this story, picturing the story that was just told. Since entering into and seeing this picture, there have been 6,500,000 myriad billions of turning bodies of all-inclusive study. How many? And since seeing into this picture just happened, in the moment between now and the previous moment, there have been 6,500,000 myriad billions of turning bodies of all-inclusive study. There's many phrases in here that are interesting Zen phrases, like turning bodies is the free, unstuck body that can turn when it's in a tight place. Leisurely entering the monastery and leisurely leaving the monastery is not all-inclusive study. This seems to be a little admonition about this practice of all-inclusive study being the complete and thorough examination of one point. So, putting aside the monastery, as we have this upcoming practice period, is a time where we, you know, some of us will commit to being here. We will, of course, since we don't live here, we'll be coming and going, but to leisurely come and leave the Zen Center is not all-inclusive study. Like, I think I'll drop by and practice a little all-inclusive study today. Now, of course, we can always drop into the moment, and we do. But maybe it's something about leisurely or non-wholeheartedly, maybe is the point. Seeing with the entire eyeball is all-inclusive study. Striking all the way through is all-inclusive study. to understand that the skin of the face is very thick is all-inclusive study. Dogen likes to use these strange phrases. And there happens to be a footnote here that this phrase, the skin of the face is very thick, comes from this story that's somewhat tangential, but in a way completely related to the point. So for the sake of including this other story from the Vimalakirti Sutra that the Buddha taught, one of the climax points of this sutra is a discussion with Vimalakirti and many other bodhisattvas about the Dharma gate of non-duality, which incidentally, to tie in this Vimalakirti Sutra chapter on the Dharma gate of non-duality to the sixth ancestor, at least in the modern temple of the sixth ancestor at Cao Chi in China, there's I visited there, and there's many gates as you, big mountain gates, you know, as you get closer to the monastery, which is like you're passing through different gates with different Dharma protectors and guardians as you go closer and closer to the Buddha, where actually, I think I mentioned before, the sixth ancestor at the very end, behind all the different Buddha halls and meditation halls at the very end, is the body, the true body, they call, of the sixth ancestor, which is a mummified body of Hui Nung from the 6th century, supposedly, with all his features perfectly intact, lacquered. Apparently, the true body, they did this sometimes. They poured lacquer into a recently deceased body. And so it can be saved for eternity. Anyway, the first gate that you go through, kind of a simple gate, it says up on the top of the gate, Dharma gate of non-duality. I think taken from this Vimalakirti Sutra. So to even get to the first Dharma protectors, you have to pass through the Dharma gate of non-duality. Was Rosie on that trip? That China trip? Yeah, Rosie passed through the Dharma gate of non-duality. So in this chapter on the Dharma gate of non-duality in the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti is asking all these bodhisattvas how they would describe the Dharma gate of non-duality, and they give all these great answers. And at the end of the line of all the bodhisattvas is the greatest perfect wisdom bodhisattva Manjushri. And so Vimalakirti, who's not a great bodhisattva mahasattva, but an ordinary layman, who's the star of this sutra. And Vimalakirti asks, what's the gate of non-duality which the bodhisattva enters? And Manjushri says, if it matches my understanding, there's no word, no speech, no teaching, and no knowing of all things. And it is apart from all questions and answers. Basically, the same thing that Nanyue said. To say it's this misses the mark, Manjushri says. After all these great answers other bodhisattvas have given, he says, you know, to say anything about it is not it. This non-duality Dharma gate. So, apart from all questions and answers, how thick-skinned the face is, this is entering the Dharma gate of non-duality. So, this is not explained, but when we meet the world with this face, with all its sensory organs, we usually don't experience things so directly. There's some thick skin of conceptuality blocking our direct experience. One way we could hear this, to say it's this or that or any of these things, none of that cuts it. How thick skin the face is. So Dogen is quoting this line. Amazingly, I feel like that he could pull at this point that it being said about the greatest answer of Manjushri being, well, to say it's this and that doesn't quite cut it. That Dogen pulls that little point out of there. That's the kind of thing he does, right? I should mention the end of the sutra story here at this point. This is the end of this long chapter, all these bodhisattvas. And so Manjushri, the great wisdom bodhisattva, says this, to say it's this misses the mark. How thick skin the face is. And then Manjushri asks Vimalakirti. He says, now we've all spoken, all the bodhisattvas have said, have told their entrances to the Dharma gate of non-duality. What do you say, Vimalakirti? And Vimalakirti says, which then later became called the lion's roar of Vimalakirti. He outdid all the bodhisattvas, even Manjushri, who said, to say it's this misses the mark. Manjushri often got in trouble for pointing out the nature of reality with even the most simple phrases. Like Manjushri once said, when the Buddha got up on the seat, Manjushri said, clearly observe, the Dharma of the Dharma King is thus, is such. Got it? Mm-hmm. And then the Buddha got down from the seat and left, because even though the Buddha couldn't be defiled, Manjushri, in trying so hard to say it so simply and straightforwardly, still annoyed the Buddha enough that he had to leave. He couldn't quite defile him, but he confused people a little too much by saying something, period. Please, if you have anything to ask or bring up. Yes, Rosie.
So, is our school, the one that comes down from Dogen, a mind-only school?
Well, Zen doesn't become defiled by falling into any school. Even to call it the Zen school, Dogen's got a whole other fascicle where he says, people call this Zen, but actually, we shouldn't say this. Along the same lines. And of course, after he died, it became, and we shouldn't call it the Soto lineage and all these names that we put on it. But shortly afterwards, of course, it was called that, because that's what we do, we define things. So I would say that the Zen school of Dogen and of and the Linji school also, of which Nanyue was a predecessor to Linji. Are very influenced by the mind-only school, which even in its time, when the school, we say the founders of the mind-only school were Asanga and Vasubandhu in India, but it seems that at the time they were living, they didn't call it a school. Most of these schools don't get called that until after their founders are gone, like Zen and Soto and so on. But what later came to be called the mind-only school, or, you know, tenet system in India, greatly influenced, it seems, if we speak of this like kind of historically, what we call the Zen school, the teachings of mind only. Now we have in Mahayana Buddhism, we have these two main schools, let's say like philosophical schools of thought or tenet systems, systems of tenets, philosophical tenets. And one of them is called the mind only school, and one of them is called the middle way school. And so Cittamatra and Madhyamika. These are really the, at least according to like modern and ancient, like Tibetan and East Asian systems, that these two systems of thought of in Mahayana Buddhism, mind only and middle way founded by Nagarjuna, and mind only founded by Asanga and Vasubandhu. And I would say, and I thought about someday maybe trying to write this book, that how the Zen school is influenced by the teachings of mind only and middle way, and they're both woven in there, and you can find within Dogen, for example, and many other teachings, you can find these ways of talking about mind only and the middle way in very fresh, new Zen kind of language. So they don't usually quote the old sutras, because that's the style of Zen, is they just develop this fresh, new way of just using stories, basically. But the stories, and sometimes they do directly quote mind-only teachings, but usually it's like this one. I would say you could see this story of Nan Yue and the Sixth Ancestor as a mind-only story. And when we get further into this sutra later this winter, about there's these three natures, three characteristics of all phenomena, I think this is a nice story to demonstrate the work, the interworkings of these three natures, which is an important teaching of the mind-only school. So, not officially, in Zen we say, what is it like, officially, not even a needle can pass through, but unofficially, a horse and buggy can pass through. You're welcome. Yes.
Carolyn. In this way of thinking, the verb defile, to defile, is very intriguing. And it sounds a lot, or it sounded to me rather close to define. As if defiling is a mental action that limits, that seeks to contain and reify. Would that be the sense of defilement?
That is very interesting that in English those words are only one letter apart. Mm. Yeah.
Because ordinarily for us to defile is a very strong
negative
verb. So I'm wondering if it has a slightly different connotation in this.
I think it is very related to define, and that's why I think it's, for me it seems very warm even to say. It's not that there's no practice in realization, it's just that they can't be defiled. It means like, because it does have a little bit of a nasty edge to it, that word, but they can't be defiled. This is what all Buddhas and ancestors protect and maintain, non-defilement, that things cannot ever, no matter what we do, no matter how strongly we try to make them real and believe them, and it's a book and it's mine, it's like, sorry, it can't be defiled by all of that grasping. It can't be. So it can't be so nasty.
Just as it can't be defined.
As an author, that Carolyn is.
As someone who makes them, is about to have one arrive in my life in a few weeks. I think of a book as much more, there's much more preceding the appearance of the physical object that I kind of grasp and say it's mine. There's all the thought and all the contributions and all the layers and causes and conditions. There's an enormous amount before it and also around it and after it, because then the book, one hopes, generates all kinds of responses in readers and reaches unknown numbers of people and affects them. So that book, while it looks like a thing in front of you, and I can't wait to see what mine, nonetheless has a life in the world and in time that is vast.
Mm-hmm. You could even say, I hesitate to even bring this up at this time of night, but you put that so beautifully that to me this is very much the teaching, this, as I mentioned, the three natures is right there, which is also like saying it's not that there's no practice in realization. It's not that there's no book, and that book is life. Like you say, it has a life of its own. That's one of these three natures, we could call it, for now, life. And the way that the life of a book or anything, any appearing thing, like completely affects all these other things and people and amazingly, interdependently, intimately interwoven with everything. That's one of these three natures. And we could actually say that nature of the life of the book can't be defiled by our ideas of it. We could say the defilement is one of the three natures. There's the life of the book, there's the defilement of the book, which is calling it a book, but also even saying, well, look how the book affects that person and that person. It's way beyond. Its life is way vaster than we can imagine. But any thought we could try to limit this, the life of this book by our thoughts, that's, we call the imputational nature. The imputational nature. And the life of the book is like the other dependent nature. The way the book is like dependent and interwoven with all things. And then the third nature is the way that it's undefiled. That it's ultimately can't be defiled. That anything we say about it doesn't reach it. And as the sutra says, that's what's called the thoroughly established, the consummate nature of the book. And as the sutra says, this is what we call suchness. The non-defilement of the book is what's technically called suchness in the mind-only school. The suchness of the book. So anything we say about, well, the way the book just like looks just like this, that's not actually quite it. It's the way, like, that we can't get a hold of what this is, even when we think we can. That ungraspability, that non-defilement, the thoroughly established nature of the book, which actually, it's thoroughly established because that nature doesn't come and go. It's always eternally undefiled. So this is a brief preview of this sutra. Hmm. We dedicate any merit arising from this discussion to the complete awakening of all beings. May they rest at ease in the suchness of all phenomena. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them.